Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 80,000 members nationwide, and New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 7,000 members and organizers, organized into branches, who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Join now by going to bit.ly/letsjoindsa. My name is Desiree Joy Frias. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a South Bronx native on the organizing committee of the Bronx Upper Manhattan branch of the Democratic Socialists of America. I also rescue food through mutual aid with my comrades here in the borough. Tonight, we are talking about how we can care for the caretakers, the nurse next to the ICU bed, the physical therapist at the long-term care facility, or the millions of other frontline workers, all essential, that care for our sick, provide critical services for those living with disabilities, and keep our hospitals and nursing homes running. We will be talking today with experts in the healthcare field about the COVID-19 crisis. This podcast is not a substitute for medical advice, and you should consult a primary care physician for your own personal care needs or eligibility for the vaccine. I know this is a deeply personal subject, and I want to honor everyone's values and beliefs while grounding this segment in the science and public health knowledge of our guests. Because this is not medical advice, we won't be answering questions on the air for tonight's segment, just sharing based on the research that we've both done. But first, we're going to hear the headlines with Andrew Calloway. Our headlines are brought to you now.
A report from the city's Department of Investigation confirmed that the NYPD escalated violence at this summer's protests over the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. The report blamed the commissioner and other higher-ups in the department for a failed strategy and enforcement policy. Mayor de Blasio, who had previously defended the police's handling of the protests, has apologized. Ahead of a possible emergency session of the state legislature, New York Assembly Speaker Carl Heastie is unwilling to commit to either an eviction moratorium or tax increases of $4 billion. The Senate reportedly supports both measures. Governor Cuomo announced a revamped COVID rent relief program after strict eligibility requirements left $60 million of the federal money initially allocated unspent. Housing advocates question whether the charges are enough to address the rent arrears tenants face and whether there's enough time to implement the program. The City Council passed a bill that protects fast food workers from being fired without a valid reason and allows them to appeal terminations through arbitration. The New York City Department of Education announced major changes to the admission process at hundreds of city schools in an effort to address segregation. The changes include barring middle schools from using test scores or other academic screens for admission, administering the specialized high school admissions test at middle schools across the city rather than only at a few campuses, and eliminating district-based admission preferences. The City Council voluntarily recognized the first members of the Union of Council Staffers, making it the first legislative staff union in the state. The staffers first requested recognition in January. Attorneys and social workers at Queens Defenders, the borough's public defender agency, have voted to unionize. The 2021 race for Manhattan District Attorney could determine the future of the Special Narcotics Prosecutor, a unique office created in the 1970s to focus exclusively on charging drug crimes. Multiple candidates for the job have indicated a willingness to abolish or reform the office. The MTA board approved a budget that excludes the most extreme potential cuts, such as a 40% decrease in subway service, because the agency is expecting $4 billion in federal aid. Council members Helen Rosenthal, District 6, Upper West Side, and Stephen Levin, District 33, Williamsburg and downtown Brooklyn, have introduced a bill in the City Council that would bar the NYPD from conducting outreach to people experiencing homelessness. NYCDSA's victorious 2020 slate of state legislators has endorsed its 2021 slate of city council candidates, Adolfo Abrio, Alexa Aviles, Tiffany Caban, Michael Hollingsworth, Jaslyn Kaur, and Brandon West. A state judge denied a request to block the use of ranked choice voting in a special city council election next year. Voters approved ranked choice voting in a 2019 ballot question. The Campaign Finance Board, which oversees the city's public campaign matching program, has disbursed $17.3 million in public funds to 61 candidates, including several DSA-endorsed candidates. Janos Marton, considered to be one of the more progressive 2021 candidates for Manhattan DA, dropped out of the race due to fundraising difficulties. Lindsay Boylan, a former aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo and current Manhattan Borough President candidate, accused Cuomo of sexually harassing her while she worked in his office.
Our headlines were brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYCDSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So since our guest, Jamise, and I are both women of color with experience in the public health field, I wanted to center tonight's discussion on the impact of the COVID-19 crisis in the community of color. Jamise Lam has a doctorate in nursing from Duke University, a master's of nursing informatics. She has 10 years of nursing experience specializing in care of neurologically impaired patients in the ICU. Her literature has been published in academic health journals. She's also the godmother of my son, and we met at a DSA meeting 2 years ago. So that's my personal disclosure. Jamise, welcome.
Hi. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Jamise, as you know, the American healthcare system is collapsing. In Los Angeles, California, which is a town of 10 million people, there are 63 ICU beds left. In Kansas, a nurse spent 17 hours looking for a bed. And Dr. Richard Watson in Wichita, Kansas, told the Eagle that sometimes they have to look for beds in Nebraska, Oklahoma, another state. So what was the state of hospitals and the system before COVID-19?
Wow, yeah, that's a pretty big question. What I will say in short is that from what I've seen, it's been lacking for quite a while. Like you said, I started nursing about 10 years ago. And in that time, for the first, I would say 6 months to a year on the floor, we had no nursing assistants, which means I and other nurses were responsible for pushing, pulling, cleaning patients that were sometimes 2-3 times our size on our own. As a result, myself and other of my fellow nurses had to go out on due to back injuries, just physical fatigue. It was rather routine that people would come up, maybe a supervisor would come up and just kind of tell people to go to employee health. Like that was something that my charger told me, go to employee health if your back is hurting from a long night. They kind of anticipated that would happen.
And your back was hurting because you're moving patients sometimes by yourself, it sounds.
Yeah, definitely by myself. Frequently we were short-staffed at times. There were nurses that we would have to be pulled to other floors to help with a unit that was even less staffed. Frequently there were doctors that were overloaded with patients. They had way more, especially at nights, they had way more patients than was feasible to really care for. And everyone, I'm going to reinforce this, everyone, the majority of people that I worked with were extremely professional, did their best, cared, but the system itself kind of grinded them down.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds really, and you know, from what it sounds like, this is a logistics issue that there's not enough nurses, there's not enough doctors or beds. Yeah. Why didn't they just hire more workers?
Well, when that was raised from an employee level, from a worker level, there was a very common refrain, which was, it's not in the budget, or they would say, if you folks would just discharge patients faster, as soon as the order came in, then we could get more patients in, and then we could justify hiring more nurses or more nursing assistants. And, you know, that it was kind of put on us that, well, if you worked faster, we'd get more money, and if we got more money, then we could get more help. So that's kind of how it was framed.
Wow. And so we have a system that's like this, exhausted nurses, you know, not enough care, especially for lower income people. And then COVID-19 happens. How has the healthcare landscape changed?
A couple things I'll highlight. One is that by the time COVID-19 happened, which was, you know, earlier this year, it seems like a lifetime ago, I was actually working in private practice, but I still had friends who were healthcare workers who were on the floors, kind of at ground zero for patients needing very acute care. And I would say it exacerbated kind of what already was going on. So in areas where there are not as many resources, people were really having a hard time getting any sort of help. They were going to the emergency rooms. Nurses were overwhelmed. Nurses were kind of having to do overtime more so than usual. Doctors were getting fatigued. And there was a great personal cost. A lot of friends of mine who have just been struggling to keep themselves together in the face of incredible loss, overwork. People have knee issues, back issues, mental health issues, and piling a pandemic on that was just not helpful in the least.
And, you know, I mean, who do you call? So, yeah. So, you know, if we didn't have enough doctors, if we didn't have enough nurses before the pandemic, COVID-19 hits and millions of people are flooded through our teetering healthcare system. So what can a hospital do when they don't have enough staff already and there's an emergency?
Well, in emergency conditions, if you need to plug a hole, from what I understand, at least from the worker side, you can pull in travel nurses. And these are nurses that come from different states sometimes and are paid considerably more than the nurses who actually work in the hospital that they go to. And as far as I understand, they give, you know, competent care, but their benefits and all their other expenses are kind of handled through this other agency. The thing about that is sometimes it feels like it potentially could be wasteful because, you know, if you have a need, I feel like it's maybe makes more sense to continue to hire and have extra nurses for when you need them versus kind of slapdash bringing people in.
And paying a premium, for people who travel the country doing this work. So, you know, you touched on it a bit of, you know, nurses were already dealing with physical issues, financial problems, maybe student debt, or what I really want to touch on next, which is medical debt. You know, before they did a survey in November 2019, and 139 million people were struggling with crippling medical debt. And experts say that number could top over 200 million after the pandemic, if people are forced to incur medical debt from their COVID-19 treatment. So what role do insurance companies play in the care that patients receive at hospitals?
Well, from a kind of nursing worker perspective, we don't get very much insight into finances on the hospital level other than you know, we're doing good, we're pulling in patients, we're pulling in money, or we're not doing so good, we need to like increase throughput. That's kind of as much as we get led into the process. We aren't really, beyond not spending too much on certain supplies for people, we aren't kind of told how much we're charging for things. But what I will say is you do definitely feel the hand of capital and you do feel the hand of insurance companies when it comes to care of your patients, specifically when it comes to discharge. Discharge is a very vulnerable time when it's your responsibility to make sure this patient has everything that they need to be successful once they're out of the door of the hospital. And there were many times where I felt, and I'm sure there are lots of other nurses and doctors and medical professionals who have felt that a patient who needs to stay was not able to do so because it was not authorized by the insurance company. And you are able in some instances to fight that, but
medical necessity.
Yeah. But that, you know, ultimately the decision is about payment is up to the insurance company. So, you know, lots of times you have to hustle and try to teach family members as much as you can about the medication, about the care, about any other devices the patient needs to go home with, which can be kind of an undue burden for people that may not have medical literacy. And you do what you can, but
you're and it's the nurses. So the nurses who are already in pain and overworked and understaffed and too many hours, you're supposed to do basically exit
and you
teaching.
You advocate for your patient, and that is, you know, that is my job. That is our job, and I feel very strongly about that. But it's an uphill battle when it's like this has to happen or else. And even the time of day, there's a particular discharge time, and if everything is not ready by that time, it comes down to you. Why are you, you know, why are you delaying things, you know? So, and at the end of the day, you have to think about your patient, and sometimes it feels like not everyone is doing that.
Well, thank you for sharing that bit on nursing conditions. And we're going to hear from a nurse here in our borough of the Bronx, Michelle, who's going to speak more on nursing conditions.
Hi, my name is Michelle Gonzalez. I am a nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. I am also on the NYSNA Executive Committee. NYSNA is my union here. I have been a part of the executive committee probably for about 5 years now. And I basically do that. And I'm also an activist in the Bronx. I'm on the Community Board 7, which is my local community board. And I'm really interested in trying to improve the standards of the Bronx, the healthcare of the Bronx, and doing whatever necessary to get the changes we need here.
And it's my understanding that there's a strike going on. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
There is a strike. The Nurses of New Rochelle, it's a small hospital. There's about 200 nurses there. They took a strike vote maybe about, I'd like to say, mid-November. This strike vote was about a 98% strike vote, which meant overwhelmingly that the nurses voted to go out on strike. The nurses went out on a 2-day strike, December 1st and 2nd, after a 10-day notice. They gave the hospital 10 days to negotiate. The hospital, Montefiore, New Rochelle, basically told the nurses if they would drop some of their standards, that they would negotiate this contract. It was really unfortunate because a lot of the things that the nurses are asking for really would improve the care of the overall community and the overall quality of life for the nurses. And I say this in the following ways. The nurses are asking for, first and foremost, staffing. There is a chronic problem with staffing and understaffing in our hospitals. The hospitals, in my opinion, are using COVID as an excuse to understaff hospital systems throughout this country. I think it's an excuse. I think if the country needs nurses, because you can't have patients in bed without nurses to care for them. If the country needs nurses, we need to start to develop programs to graduate nurses and get nurses to the bedside. With that being said, the nurses are asking for more staff. We're asking for more staff, a retiree health benefit, and tuition reimbursement. What they were offered at the table was 2.5% a year, after we know that management got a 3% raise a year, what they got offered was no additions to staffing, no improvement in current contract language about staffing, denying the nurses with regards to a float pool. The float pool would very much help the hospital in its entirety, because when the hospital is short, there would be a group of nurses who could float throughout the hospital when the hospital needs nurses. Currently, nurses have specialties, and we're very proud of those specialties, but they take years and months of training to acquire. And with that being said, I stand behind these nurses of New Rochelle. I'm very proud of watching their fight.
Hell yeah. And can you tell me, you know, for anybody who's listening and wants to get involved, you know, what can people do? Where should they go?
I think there's two things that nurses really need to do and the community could help us to accomplish, is that we as nurses need universal guidelines for staffing. So what that would mean is like legislation to protect us, similar to what California has. California has safe staffing guidelines, at least for the last 10 years. This protects like both patients and nurses from harm, from a bad outcome. It helps the nurse prevent any accidents or mistakes, and it also helps our ability to catch things quicker. So with that being said, I think one of the things people can do is help us ask our Congress and our assembly people to make sure that there's ratios in place to protect both patients and communities. Secondly, I think the other thing I would like to say is we really need universal health care in this country. It's really terrible to see where we're at currently with the state of current health care. I'm scared for my population in the Bronx. We're number 62 in healthcare outcomes in New York State. There are 62 counties in New York State. So that means the Bronx falls last on healthcare outcomes. I really would hope that I could help to tell people like the benefits of the New York Health Act, which would help us enable in getting health care for all New Yorkers, which would include vision and dental, which currently I barely have. So I think it would be an improvement to our current system.
And can I just ask, is there anything else that you would like to leave our listeners with?
I think, Andrew, just really quick, I am a nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. As a union delegate, I work with nurses in NYSNA throughout the system. I am always trying to advocate not just for the nurse, but for our patients, our community, and the profession, to advocate for us as nurses to try and improve our standards and quality of life. With that being said, I have been privileged to work with the nurses of New Rochelle for the last, I'd like to say, 6 months, and a little bit longer than that too, because I've had a relationship with some of the nurses there for a few years now. With that being said, I had the privilege of getting involved with their negotiations and their campaign for a contract. These poor nurses have been without a contract for 2 years. We've been at negotiations with the hospital, and, you know, there's one commonality with my health institution. They are chronically understaffing our nurses. It doesn't matter if you're in Mount Vernon or if you're in New Rochelle or if you're in the Bronx. This institution kind of has gravely put us in danger and put our licenses at risk. Nurses at New Rochelle are known to have up to 8 med-surg patients at times. This is scary because we know that every med-surg patient past the 6th patient, so the 7th, 8th, 9th patient, has a higher risk of mortality. This is scary for us because it puts our nursing licenses that we work so hard to accomplish at risk. So part of the reason I fight is because I want to improve standards for not just nurses, but for workers in general. None of us should have to worry about how we're going to pay our mortgages. We are in a time of economic destruction for a lot of families where their family members have been unemployed for a few months. That is a lot of the reason why I really think we need to pass the New York Health Act. But what That being said, the fight is an everyday fight. It is an everyday struggle. The more people who get into this fight, the stronger we will be. I'm really hoping the rest of the collective joins the fight in fighting back against greedy employers who are giving us the shaft.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Welcome back. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 Revolutions Per Minute. Getting back to our interview with Jamise Lam, who has a doctorate in nursing, about COVID-19 and its impact here in New York City on those who care for us. Those in our hospitals, rehabs, and extended care facilities that are overflowing with COVID patients and those recovering with its lasting physical effects. So, Jamise, Michelle said there's no safe staffing guidelines in New York State. As someone who goes to hospitals, that's not good. And she said to me about 8 med-surg patients.
Yeah, when I heard that, it was shocking to me in some ways, but in other ways, not so shocking. The short answer is absolutely, we do not have ratios here. There are recommendations. There are certain hospitals that have agreements based on the contract of how many patients, but those aren't really legally binding. If you have a problem with your staffing, you can fill out a complaint about it, but you're still responsible for those patients for that designated amount of time. When I hear 8 patients for a med-surg floor, I'm thinking about everything that has to be done. Just for a single patient, at the beginning of your shift, you're supposed to completely understand that patient's medical history, all their medications, why they're getting those medications, if there are any tests that need to be completed, if there's any labs that need to be drawn or sent down, if you have questions about those labs, if there's anything that needs follow-up, if you need to communicate with the doctor regarding any questions, and organizing any of the care that needs to go on, that all has to happen on your shift. And imagine doing that for 8 individual souls that you're responsible for.
That sounds so stressful. I mean, especially with the staffing issues that you were talking about, how there's just not enough people working there. It's too much pressure.
Yeah. And I mean, to add more to that, in addition to those things, patients also get meals. Some patients need assistance with meals. So if 6 out of the 8 of your patients need assistance with 2 meals that might be happening on your shift, they might have medications every 2 hours or every hour, depending on how sick they are. There are also patients who are on ventilators who might be on your floor, which means if that vent goes off because they're coughing or they need assistance in any way, you need to appear at their bedside and understand what's going on. So having that much of a patient load does not seem safe to me. And it's amazing that nurses are able to do that every day. And they deserve better. They deserve to be able to do their job in a way that's safe for their patients at the end of the day. So I really feel for them. And it's one of the reasons why there is a lot of burnout right now. People have been struggling for a long time giving a good quality of care in an institution that has not allowed them to do so.
Yeah, so it seems like a lot of the issues in hospitals are really about finances and capital. Mm-hmm. We already know from reports that hospital administrators up at the top can make millions of dollars, like the director of the hospital, while nurses who are unionizing on the floor are, you know, begging for increases in pay and, you know, looking forward to what our healthcare system could become. You know, what are some of the dreams that you have for the American healthcare system? If we had some radical changes.
Oh goodness. So many dreams. I think starting out with, Medicare for all, healthcare for all, those things would just create a nice baseline so that patients, people who have healthcare needs, which is every single one of us at one point of our lives are going to need healthcare for one reason or another, it's so that it's not their first time seeing a doctor in 20 years when they're coming in for acute strokes, or they can afford their medications after they get discharged, so that they can see a specialist outside of a hospitalization. These are just basic things that every person in the entire country deserves. So I'd like to see that. I'd like to see coverage for, like the previous person was saying, for dental issues, as we have known for quite a long time now. Oral disease, gum disease, and heart disease are linked. So it doesn't make sense that you can treat the rest of the body, but not...
But teeth are a luxury.
Yeah, I think someone on Twitter said that they're luxury bones, and I tend to agree. They're seen as luxury bones to the medical establishment for reasons that aren't quite clear to me. So that's another thing I'd like to see.
And vision. I mean, as vision. Someone, you know, just as someone who wears glasses, the fact that we don't guarantee that everyone who needs to see can see clearly. These are just...
Yeah, what a concept there.
We all have the same, you know...
Yeah, so those things, I would honestly, nurses, I think, need unions. They need guarantees that they're going to have a certain standard in their working environment. There are lots of hand hazards around. Nurses have to deal with patients that have, or places that have radiation. There are toxic chemicals you deal with. There are patients that, for one reason or another, can't control themselves. You can get hit. I've gotten assaulted on the job. I've gotten spit on. I've gotten kicked. That was definitely something that happened. So I think just taking care of the people that take care of the rest of us, I think is very important. I mean, that's a good place to start. I'm sure I'm not...
That sounds like the floor.
that's kind of the basic part. And then beyond that, I'm sure there's lots of discussions that can be had. But those things in and of themselves would be fantastic. And that's what my hope is. I think as a country, we can definitely get there if we tell the right stories. And I think right now there haven't been enough nurses in the media telling their stories.
Well, because they're burnt out. I mean, yes, you know, well, that's the tactic of capitalism to keep you so burnt out at your job so that you don't unionize, you don't strike like Michelle and the other nurses at NYSNA, you don't organize, you don't fight for better conditions because your back is literally broken, your spirit is broken. You're dealing with all the same mental health problems that someone working in any other field may be dealing with, and even on a heightened level because of the high stress of your job. And it's just like, why aren't we taking care of our nurses and doctors? I guess the assumption from the public, I guess, would be that, you know, doctors and nurses get the best health care because they're doctors and nurses. They work there. Is that what you see?
In my experience, I mean, it certainly helps. If you have a lot of friends and people close in your life that are in the healthcare space, but it's not a guarantee of anything. I've known many people who worked in the healthcare space who were struggling with certain chronic conditions and had a hard time getting a hold of it. A lot of it has to do with juggling the lifestyle of being a floor nurse or whatever else, and also managing your own health. It's hard to take care of yourself and work 12-hour shifts 13 times a month. It's hard to care for sick family members when you only get a certain amount of time off for that, or we're short staffed, so you have to come in, or we can't get you to switch that day. So, you know, nurses are people and they have lives that require changes, and you're not always able to get that. So that's another thing. People have children. There's a lot of, especially, you know, if you're in one of the states where nurses are higher paid, you know, you may be the primary breadwinner in your family. And so all the additional kind of stress that comes with that, caring for people physically and financially can be a lot. So, it's a challenge, but we continue to bear it and do well at it. And I just think that it's time for the medical establishment and for the government to kind of step up and support us in the way that we need.
Yeah. I mean, so I had a pretty big medical event this year. I gave birth to my son, Lorenzo, on March 12th, who's your godson. Mm-hmm. And so March 12th is a wild date. You know, it's one day after, or one day before, it was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. So the hospital had already not allowed my family to come and be part of the birthing experience. It was just my partner and I. Luckily, I got to have him with me for that. But I remember getting ready for picking a doctor by basically looking up like maternal mortality rates at the hospitals in New York City. And once I saw the numbers that based on my, you know, race and ethnicity of being Afro-Latinx, like that I would have higher mortality rates at New York City hospitals than I would if I went to Yonkers, I chose to go to Yonkers. And I have the privilege and the luxury of using, you know, a vehicle to get to that hospital to use my state healthcare. But like these are, I feel like, you know, we're forced to make different decisions as people of healthcare, as people of color interacting with the healthcare system. Do you feel that like the playing field is level based on class or race?
I'm going to go ahead and say it's a no for me, dog, on that one. Absolutely not. There's a whole section of medical academic study called health disparities that addresses these issues. People of color, women, people that identify as trans, all have worse outcomes in different aspects of medical care. How it's framed, from what I can tell, is that somehow there's some inherent quality of these groups that makes them more vulnerable to these things. It's never framed as, are these people treated differently by the medical establishment? And, you know, this is not an easy thing for me to discuss, but I have seen where different patient complaints will be treated differently based on who's saying it.
Yeah, exactly. There's been studies that shown that even what, you know, doctors give women of color less painkillers, even after they've had the same procedure as a white woman. They're given, prescribed less painkillers as if it's not the same pain.
You know, what's interesting is that I think that was actually cited as one of the reasons why prescription pain medications haven't been abused as much in the Black community. I remember reading something, and please forgive me if I'm wrong, but that doctors were more hesitant to give people of color pain medications, and so there wasn't as much of an opportunity for that to become an issue with abuse down the line. But yes, you're 100%. You're 100% right on that, and I've had to think about that when I'm treating patients. Do I need to advocate more intensely for one type of patient because I know the way that they speak or their understanding of the situation will be looked upon a different way by a provider? And that's unfortunate, and I think it's definitely underreported and definitely something that is not looked at enough at all. I think there's a great hesitancy in medicine for us to look at ourselves and say, hey, you know, where are we going wrong? What can we do better? And that's definitely one of the ways. Definitely one of the ways. So yeah, no, you will get, just like in all other parts that Capital touches, you will be treated differently based on how you present.
We're talking with Dr. Janice Lamb. Mm-hmm. Who has a doctorate in nursing and 10 years of experience, including working in the ICU. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking with Dr. Janice Lamb about the COVID-19 crisis and its impact on those who care for us. So as of tonight, the total cases in the United States of COVID-19 has reached 18,887,000, adding over 203,000 cases from yesterday. In total, we've lost 333,907 people in this country to COVID-19. But a lot of scientists think that there's a way out. The FDA has approved two vaccines for emergency use, the Pfizer vaccine first, and then a few days ago, the Moderna vaccine. Likely to be approved next is the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, which is currently in trials in the United States. Members of Congress, President-elect Biden, and Director of the National Institute of Infectious Diseases, Anthony Fauci, and others have already taken the first jab and scheduled their second dose as states across the country start to provide these same doses to frontline workers. A large majority of Americans, 71%, say that they will definitely or probably get a COVID-19 vaccine, according to a study that came out on Tuesday from the Kaiser Family Foundation. That's good to hear because scientists have earmarked another number, 83% of people have to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity in the United States, or basically to reduce the number of cases to so low that they can be isolated and treated without having them spark a fresh outbreak. So vaccines are a very personal issue, very hot button, because they come into this aspect of bodily autonomy. And I want to respect everyone's views, but again, like I said at the start of the show, I want to ground this in the science. And so, Jamise, tell me more about the vaccine and what you think it means, to this crisis.
Well, for me, I think the vaccine represents hope. Hope that we can get through this, that this will be a tool in the arsenal for getting this thing under control. We've seen a lot of loss behind this pandemic, and grasping at absolutely anything we can get that will kind of help mitigate it. I'm not here to kind of tell people what they should and should not do regarding the vaccine. I think if that's something that you would like to do, please do that. But I think everyone, no matter what, should be practicing good pandemic hygiene, for lack of a better word, using your mask, distancing, not getting together in groups, washing your hands, all that basic stuff, I think will really help out to getting us where we need to be. But I think it's a good thing. I mean, anything we can do to kind of get this thing under control is great. I've had a lot of personal experience with COVID. I have lost a family member to this earlier in the year. I've had one family member who got it but has since recovered, who's in a long-term care facility. One suspected case very close to me, and then I myself got it in early April, I believe that was. And it was extremely frightening. It is not something to be played with. It's something to be avoided 100%.
Yeah.
I got it, interestingly enough, I got it, or how I suspected that I got it was getting to work every day. I was riding the subway approximately 2 hours every day. And
to your job as a nurse.
To my job as a nurse.
To interact with people and take care of them.
Yes, and this is before we got definitive advice on whether or not to wear a mask. So I was just kind of freely breathing that subway air.
Yeah, and we were told, don't wear the masks.
Yeah, so that...
Save them for medical professionals.
Yeah.
Which was you.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So that happened, and it gave me a very, very different perspective to be at once a caregiver and someone who needed care at the same time. Luckily, I did not have to be hospitalized. I had a couple close calls, but I was able to mostly recover at home with the help of a very, very lovely roommate. But it was rough. And when I did need medical assistance, I got on an app through my insurance company and asked to speak with a provider for advice. And that provider got back to me approximately 12 hours later. I was too lethargic to even answer my phone at that point. I did get the voicemail, and in that voicemail, I got kind of an angry message that was saying that I had done something wrong for not picking up the phone the first time it rang, and that I was wasting space for other people who needed that provider. I needed that provider, but was not able to get in contact with them. So that was kind of one of the few times I was able to get some assistance when I needed it. I knew to stay away from. I knew that since my breathing was okay, I didn't need to go to the hospital just yet, but I wanted some guidance as to what to expect. Luckily, I have lots of people in my life who are in medicine, so I kind of leaned on them for help, but
Fact that that was her response, she doesn't know you're a nurse.
Yeah, it was disheartening to get an angry voicemail from someone I had reached out to for help through this telehealth app. I can only imagine what people who were not insured, people who did not have the, you know, the luck to have someone who they lived with who was able to assist them. I relied on people in the DSA who sent me food, who got me masked, who checked on me. Like, a lot of those things kind of filled that care gap that I had. But, you know, not everyone has that. And I would like to see a country where I don't have to phone a friend, you know, the next time.
For your medical
needs.
I mean, you can phone a friend for a lot of things, moving. Yeah. You know, we've helped you with that. But you should be able to rely on medical professionals for medical services.
So, yeah, that, I mean, COVID has been intensely personal for me as a person of color, as a healthcare provider, as a New Yorker. And I know a lot of people have very similar stories. And I cannot wait to the day that this is all behind us. But until then, we have to do everything we can. And if that means taking the vaccine, then by all means, if that is what you want to do, please do that.
And, you know, I do want to, like, address that fact as well. You know, we have 21% of the overall population saying, no, they won't get the vaccine. But for Black Americans, it's actually 48%. And I've heard a lot echoing in our community of colors, like, that they don't trust the healthcare system, which has a lot of, you know, validity and merit. You know, why do people of color, you know, not monolithically, but at higher rates, distrust the healthcare industry and not want to take this vaccine?
Well, I'm going to echo what you said. I'm not going to, you know, I'm definitely not in charge of any other people of color. I can speak for myself and my experience and what I've some threads that I can kind of pull on from the time that I've been in healthcare. And what I will say is that there can be a disconnect in what your, how can I even, a lot of things go on in medicine. So in order for to have a trusting relationship with your provider, you need time. If you live in an area that attracts maybe new doctors who are there for a few years and then they move away to some other place, you know, you don't have a consistent person in your life that's providing you care, that can, you know, cause some distrust. How willing is your provider to use plain language? You know, there's a lot of Greek and Latin derived words that may sound foreign to you, and you may not want to say, hey, like, what does this mean? What does that mean? And kind of, or maybe the provider doesn't have time to even, maybe it's just, here's your script and, you know, I'll see you in a few weeks. That can be an issue sometimes. How much can your provider identify with your background, with your lifestyle? Do they know about you? Is this their first time in your state or not?
Exactly. Are they from here?
Are they from here? You know what I mean? Do they know the pharmacy that they go to? Do they know what it's like to live your life? All these things can color the experience that you have with a provider. There's a lot of historical implications to medicine and people of color in this state that, you know, these things get passed down orally. My grandmother has stories that she's told me about her experiences with medical providers. There's in literature, there are stories about things that may have happened. And this is not me trying to say of course, the vast majority of care providers are lovely people and they're only doing their best for their patients.
Yeah, we're just talking about implicit bias or, you know, structural racism, the things that we live with in this country that infiltrate all systems.
Are there language barriers? When you go to a big hospital, you can probably get an interpreter, but when you go to a small clinic, if you're trying to get get your script for your blood pressure pills renewed, how much language stuff can be explained through that? This is an interesting little story. I was working in a unit where we treated people with strokes. And one of the things we had to do was check blood sugars. And if it was high, we were to give them insulin at a certain scale. And there were 4 patients in a room, and 3 of them had high blood sugars. And so they needed the requisite insulin. And one patient got upset and was suggesting it was a conspiracy against Hispanic patients, because the majority of the people in that room were Hispanic, and that she actually, you know, refused the medication because she thought it was some sort of thing that was being done against people of her race, when the reality is that was just
what their blood sugar was reading that day.
Yeah. So I could understand if this is your first time in a situation like this.
And all of the other things that we listed at the top of the program are wrong. Hospital is underfunded. The staff is underfunded. Mm-hmm. They don't have what they need. The insurance company is telling them you can't give this medication, even though the person needs it. So they're maybe not even getting the care that they need. So all of these things are wrong. And then, you know, yeah, of course, people of color come into this space, are treated wrongly, have been in the past, you know, for so many reasons. And I think that distrust is just so valid. It's a form of self-protection for us. And I obviously, getting ready for the birth of my son, which I didn't know would end up a C-section. I did know that was very common for people of color to have C-section, the higher C-section rate. I ended up having a C-section because he wasn't born after 2 weeks after his due date. And yeah, I went into this experience of giving birth to a child with this, a certain level of distrust of the healthcare system and what kind of experience I was going to end up having without my consent necessarily.
Right. Yeah, so it's a delicate balance. I mean, the relationship with a provider is like any other relationship. Communication is key. You have to know what questions to ask, at what time. Like, these are things that, you know, are just hard. So I understand people's hesitation for certain things, but it's our job as providers to break through that and create a therapeutic relationship with our patients. So if patients aren't feeling comfortable, if they don't trust, it's up to us to make that right. And, you know, that's where I land on that.
Yeah. And we have a big, you know, do you have any tips? I mean, I have one that even people who are on state health insurance, like Medicaid, like I was during my pregnancy, you can still shop around. First of all, you don't have to keep the same insurance company if it's an open enrollment period. Mm-hmm. Even if you're on Medicaid or using state marketplace, you can pick a different insurance provider. And then within that insurance provider, you can shop around for a doctor. I finally, in the last 2 years, got a primary care physician named Matthew Pavis, who's in the Lower East Side. He's like awesome. He's like a really genuinely nice guy. And I feel like I can talk to him like I talk to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so important for people. I know it takes time and resources and that, to actually look for a good provider. But I think that it's important that we invest in ourselves. In our healthcare, because if you have a doctor that makes you feel uncomfortable every time you show up, it's just not going to work out for you as well.
Yeah, I think doing what you can to make yourself comfortable and being open, it can be hard because doctors and nurses are seen as being in a position of authority. So some people are hesitant to ask things, but make sure you understand everything. If you're getting a medication, why am I getting this medication? Can you tell me what it's for? Can you tell me how it works? It's our job to educate. That's as big as anything else that providers do. So if you feel like something hasn't been explained, you know, what am I going through right now? Having other people in your life that you can share, hey, let me tell you what's going on with me in case they need in case something happens and someone else needs to know. So those are kind of like basic things that you can do. I would say be careful with WebMD because you can definitely
go down the rabbit hole of self-diagnosis.
Yeah, I would stay away from that. And
if you're going to go on WebMD, what I would encourage instead, there's actual like portals like Mount Sinai who have has created an actual like telehealth portal where you you put in your insurance information and it tells you whether or not you're covered, and you can connect within like 10 minutes to someone and ask them a health question.
Yeah.
And it was covered by my insurance. So, you know, before you self-diagnose or, you know, WebMD, try to connect to a provider who can give you an unbiased mm-hmm. professional medical opinion. Mm-hmm. And if you don't trust that one provider's, get a second opinion.
Absolutely. It's well within your rights. The more information you have, the better. I think in general, that's the case. And the more you know about yourself, the better.
And I think that that's a huge component of the decision-making that people are doing right now around whether or not they feel comfortable with getting the COVID-19 vaccine. I think that there aren't a lot of channels of information available. And so I'm really glad that you came on, Jamise, and spoke to people about this crisis. As exhausted as we all are of dealing with it, that doesn't mean that it's over. And, you know, we have to remain aware, not anxious,
very true.
You know, which is hard for me to say as someone who lives with so much anxiety. Something that really gets me more calm is talking to experts like you and, you know, doing the reading and finding out what's going on with everything so that I can have the knowledge and really the power to make a healthy decision for me and my family. So thank you so much, Jamise Lamb, for coming on the radio.
Yes.
This was WBAI 99.5 Revolutions Per Minute.